It must be conference season, not political party conferences, but medical conferences. I see that Pulse has just done its Pulse Live big day, and one of their key speakers was Jeremy Hunt, ex-health secretary. He's been reflecting on the state of general practice and come to the conclusion that one of the key things we need to do is bring back the joy to the profession. We need to make it fun again. There's a certain irony from this, given that this was the man responsible for QoF and CQC, but he does have a point. When was the last day you came home from a day in general practice and thought, that was fun? Boy, I cannot wait to do that again. 11-hour days and patients moaning it's taken a week to get an appointment does sap the pleasure out of things. Of course, the workforce crisis has a big part to play in this. It's the key feature of this month's BJGP. They've really nailed being topical over the last few months. But despite the rhetoric, there is no easy solutions here. So in the absence of being able to magic up the 5,000 GPs that Jeremy Hunt tried to a few years ago, maybe there's some other ways we can put some fun back into the profession. How about uniforms, which are clown outfits? Bells on shoes? Comedy noses that go honk? Don't fancy that? What about drinking at lunchtime, or maybe the equivalent of the Graham Norton big red chair in your consulting room? I know some friends who would suggest having an emergency cat on standby. Bad consultation? Give it a few strokes, it'll calm you down. You'd probably have to keep it in a cage, and I'm not sure about the ethics about that. Better maybe to keep it on a lead tied to your desk. Then your cat can enjoy the same level of freedom that GPs have under independent contractor status. If you're getting a cat to stroke, why not go even further? Why not go full evil villain and get a pool with a shark in it? That could speed up consultations when they feel like they're going a bit wrong. Or we could just adopt the LMC suggestion of working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. That would make our working lives fabulous. I'd get 4 hours of my day back. Of course, patients camping outside the practice, Wimbledon style, waiting for an appointment, would be a bit of a buzzkill. So for fun, I think we're back to the cat. Emotional thermometer on the rise. Time for a stroke. Come here, mittens. Wow! Oh, the bloody thing scratched me. Whose cat are you anyway? Property of one Jeremy Hunt? I thought there was something fishier than your dinner about all of this talk of fun. Never trust a politician. It's Friday, the 6th of May, and this is the Hot Topics Podcast. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. I don't know when you're listening to this, but thank you for joining us once again on the Hot Topics podcast from NB Medical. As usual, I am Neil Tucker here to take you through the next 20 minutes or so of news, opinions, and new research in primary care. While I remember there are lots of interesting things coming up with NB Medical in the next couple of weeks, did you know that World Asthma Day was earlier on this week? We are doing a free evening clinic on Tuesday, the 17th of May, on how to optimize asthma care and do that in an environmentally sustainable way. It's at 8 o'clock in the evening. I'll be presenting along with my colleague Zoe Norris, so please do join us. And link to that today on the podcast. At the end, we're going to have a fantastic interview with two brilliant doctors, Artie Bansal, who is a co-founder of the Greener Practice Movement, also one of the authors of a new asthma toolkit, which we'll be discussing in that free clinic. Also, Veena Agarwal, who is currently doing a fellowship with NHS England and Greener NHS, and she's going to be talking a little bit about their roles in making general practice more sustainable. But first, we're going to have a look at some of the research. So this week, we're going to talk about a couple of JAMA papers asking whether home blood pressure monitoring is helpful for earlier identification of hypertension during pregnancy. A paper in the BMJ about PCSK9 inhibitors and ezetimibe for cardiovascular risk reduction. And then just a little think about something that sounds really maybe a bit beyond the remit of general practice, but I thought was quite interesting. And that's a New England Journal of Medicine paper on some biological agent for alopecia. Okay, let's kick off with this paper in JAMA. So if you are a pregnant woman and you develop hypertension, then that increases your risk of a number of complications, also increases the risk of fetal complications as well. One of the most serious things for the woman is if it was to progress on to preeclampsia, that's when people can get really, really ill. In these two linked papers, they ask the question, does self-monitoring lead to earlier detection of hypertension during pregnancy compared with what we do in usual antenatal care? So this was published in an American journal, but the study was actually conducted in England, 15 maternity hospitals, through November 2018 and October 2019. They recruited women at 20 weeks of gestation, and they were identifying those who were either at higher risk of preeclampsia or those who already had existing chronic hypertension or who had developed gestational hypertension. They randomized them to either blood pressure self-monitoring with telemonitoring and usual care, or usual care alone, looking for the time to first recorded hypertension measured by a healthcare professional. The short answer is it doesn't appear to be beneficial. So the average times to identification of hypertension was very marginally quicker in the self-monitoring group. We're talking like a day and a half on average. That didn't reach statistical significance, unsurprisingly. Even if it did, hard to argue that that would make clinical significance. Perhaps this is not such a surprise. In the latter stages of pregnancy in the UK, women tend to have quite a lot of monitoring. They're already having blood pressure checks every few weeks. The addition of home monitoring isn't going to speed diagnosis of hypertension up very much. It would be easy to dismiss the negative findings of this study and consign it to the Hall of Research's dusty corner where no one goes and looks ever again. But I think perhaps the question being asked could be reframed, and with the pandemic, this has become more important. It's not so much, would self-monitoring add anything on top of usual care? What about if you couldn't do usual care? What if you didn't get that check every 4 weeks of your blood pressure? What if it's nothing to do with the pandemic, but you're just in a resource-poor setting in a country where they don't have great antenatal care? Could self-monitoring, perhaps beyond blood pressure as well, be a safe alternative to having regular antenatal visits? We don't know that from this research, but that would be a really interesting question to ask. On to the BMJ next, and their headline piece of research this week is it's a systematic review and network meta-analysis of PCSK9 inhibitors and ezetimibe with or without statin therapy for cardiovascular risk reduction. It asks a important question. It's comparing the impact of ezetimibe, all these PCSK9 inhibitors, on cardiovascular outcomes in adults who are taking maximally tolerated statin therapy or who are statin intolerant. So they're trying to work out what the additional benefit of either ezetimibe or a PCSK9 inhibitor is, or indeed if they're even more beneficial if you use them in combination. It's a particularly important question because this paper is focusing on real-world outcomes, hard endpoints, as opposed to surrogate markers such as reduction in LDL. And to date, most of the information we have about these lipid-lowering agents focuses on those surrogate markers. It asked quite a simple question, and then it's a triumph in making research seem really complicated, because it then goes on to have a rapid recommendation in its practice section. That's where it's trying to translate the information into the real world, into clinical decision making. It gives 8 different patient scenarios, each with multiple drug options, and then it loses me a bit, I'll be honest. Why not keep things simple? Whatever happened to inclisiran? I thought we were going to be able to get rid of PCSK9 inhibitors and just do this 6-monthly injection in general practice. Death by bureaucracy. Between the RCGP and the BMA, they seem to have thwarted NHS England's evil genius to save the UK population from cardiovascular disease, bring on stroking of the cat in the shark-filled pool. Anyway, back to the research. So the first problem we've got as people trying to understand this research is it's a network meta-analysis. So that basically means it's impenetrable to anyone other than the actual researchers. It includes 14 trials, 83,500 patients who are either on statins or statin intolerant, and then given the addition of ezetimibe or a PCSK9 inhibitor, or both. And of course, this being a network meta-analysis, what they're doing is they're using that statin group as the sort of baseline and comparing the relative merits of ezetimibe, PCSK9 inhibitors, or both against that baseline. The main outcomes they're looking for, a variety of cardiovascular outcomes like MI and stroke, and of course, cardiovascular death and all-cause mortality as well. They then further categorized the patients by their baseline cardiovascular risk. Are they low, medium, high, or very high? The easy conclusions is that ezetimibe or PCSK9 inhibitors may reduce non-fatal MIs and stroke in adults with very high or high cardiovascular risk, even if they're already receiving maximally tolerated statin therapy or if they're statin intolerant. You did not see these benefits in those with low to moderate cardiovascular risk. Neither additional agent improved all-cause mortality or cardiovascular mortality. Then we get to the really complicated bit about adding in both agents and which way round you do it. So adding ezetimibe to a PCSK9 inhibitor plus statins didn't seem to improve things. Adding a PCSK9 inhibitor to ezetimibe and statins led to a small reduction in stroke of around 1%, but no other benefits. Can we therefore conclude that PCSK9 inhibitors are more effective than ezetimibe as the initial add-on agent? You'd really hope so, given that the PCSK9 inhibitors are about £4,000 per year or thereabouts. Perhaps good news then that the authors conclude PCSK9 inhibitors seem to have the highest absolute reductions in myocardial infarctions and strokes when added to background therapy, followed by ezetimibe. Bottom line, if you're at high or very high cardiovascular risk and you're not meeting your targets on statins or you can't tolerate statins, then either of these agents is a good option for trying to further improve your risk. I'll put a link in the podcast description to the BMJ rapid recommendations. Have a look at it, see if you can figure it out for me, and then do get in touch. Remember, you can email on hottopics@nbmedical.com. You can get us on Twitter at @GPHotTopics and find us on Facebook as well. On to the last piece of research, and we're looking at this New England Journal of Medicine paper on baricitinib for alopecia areata. It was only the next day after seeing this paper that my mind flicked to the Oscars and Will Smith whacking Chris Rock because of his comments about Will Smith's wife, who's had really bad alopecia. And alopecia is one of those conditions that doesn't get much recognition. It isn't going to kill you, but we probably underestimate the profound psychological trauma that bad alopecia can have on many of our patients. It would be fabulous if we could actually help this group, but beyond just getting them to rub some placebo steroid into their head, there's basically nothing that we can do. Step in this new age of biological agents and all of a sudden we have some hope. So baricitinib is a name that you might recognize. I mean, I say that loosely. I have to say I'd forgotten about it, but it's been used in COVID. It's a anti-rheumatoid drug. I think you still use the phrase that it's a biological agent, but specifically it is an oral, that's a good start, selective reversible inhibitor of Janus kinases 1 and 2. Are you up to date with your Janus kinases? I am sadly behind, but the paper helpfully suggests that the drug may interrupt cytokine signaling implicated in the pathogenesis of alopecia. So far, so good. This was a phase 3 randomized placebo-controlled trials. They looked at a higher dose of baricitinib, so 4 milligrams, a 2 milligram dose or placebo, and the primary outcome measure was reduction in SALT score to 20 or less at 36 weeks of treatment. What's a SALT score? Well, in this context, it's the severity of alopecia tool. So it's scored out of 100. 0 is no scalp hair loss. 100 is complete scalp hair loss. And the study was recruiting people who were at baseline scoring above 50. They managed to recruit 1,100 patients into two trials. I don't quite know why they split it into two trials. They're basically looking at the same thing. It makes it a little bit irritating when you're trying to communicate the result. But the bottom line is that the higher dose baricitinib was very effective. The lower dose, a bit less so, and placebo, completely hopeless. The number of people managing to get that salt score to under 20 at the end of the trial was between 33 and 39% on the 4 milligram group, 19 to 23% on the 2 milligram group, and only 3 to 6% in the placebo group. Safety always needs to be a consideration. The adverse events were slightly higher in the treatment group. They were all reported as mild to moderate. There was some increase in lipid levels. That might need some further exploration. But if you're a patient who has got complete hair loss from your alopecia, until now, your chance of improvement has been virtually zero. Here we've got an option that says a third of you might have substantial or complete resolution. Who knows how long the effects last? Who knows if you can stop treatment or if you're going to have to carry it on for a significant period of time? But this is another really positive finding from one of these biological agents. On to our interview then, and we're thinking about improving asthma care, and we're thinking about the sustainability of healthcare from the planetary perspective. And I'm lucky to be joined by two fabulous medics and experts in this area, Dr. Aarti Bansal and Dr. Veena Agarwal. I'm going to let you both introduce yourselves. Aarti, you're at the top of my screen, so over to you.
Hi, Neil. Yeah, my name's Aarti. I'm a GP in Sheffield. I founded the Greener Practice Movement a few years ago, which is the UK's primary care sustainability network. And I also work with Humber in North Yorkshire as their net zero clinical lead one day a week.
And Veena, tell me a bit about yourself.
Thanks, Neil. So hi, I'm Veena Agarwal. I'm a GP trainee in Kingston, Southwest London. And I'm currently working as a Chief Sustainability Officer's Clinical Fellow. So I'm a Sustainability Fellow at NHS England. And I'm also a co-chair of the Greener Practice South London Group.
So we're talking to both of you today because this week we've had World Asthma Day. The UK has some of the worst asthma outcomes throughout Europe. It's only beaten by Serbia, Turkey, Estonia, Spain and Cyprus. That's the group that we're sitting with. And we've also had increasing rates of asthma over the last decade. And Aarti, I know that you've been involved with publishing a superb clinical guideline on optimizing asthma care and asthma toolkit for people. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and how you can help improve asthma care whilst also reducing the environmental impact of asthma. And Veena, I know that you've been working with NHS England to improve asthma outcomes as well. And just as a reminder for everyone, so NB is putting on a free evening clinic, 8 p.m. Tuesday, the 17th of May, optimizing asthma care and thinking green. So this has been put on in conjunction with NHS England and NHS Improvement. Go to nbmedical.com to sign up, and I'll put a link in the podcast description. Let's start with Aarti. I know that you are one of the lead authors of the guideline. So tell me a little bit about how you got involved in the project.
I guess as somebody who is interested in how we can improve the quality of care generally whilst also reducing carbon emissions, because that's what we're all interested in, greener practice, a lot of us in the network were having very similar conversations around inhalers. So we were wanting to know practically, what should we be thinking about when we're thinking about reducing the carbon footprint of inhalers? Was there an approach that we should be taking? Was there a population we should be targeting? How did we actually know who we should talk to about maybe reducing the carbon footprint of their inhalers? But was there also an issue around optimizing care, and how was this linked to optimizing care? Basically, people were having the same conversations and people were asking the same questions. And there really wasn't any guidance out there to support this. And because of the network, I was aware of Dr. James Smith, who's a GP in Cambridge, and I knew he'd published work on this with people like Dr. Alex Wilkinson, who is a respiratory consultant in Hertfordshire, who started the Green Inhaler website. And so basically it was me just talking to James saying, James, I think you need to write a guide about this. Because we all are asking the same questions, and that's how it started. What was good about that was James was, because he was a GP prominent in this area, He was already part of NHS England and NHS Improvements Inhaler Working Group, which was looking at this issue of how we can support reducing emissions from inhalers, because there's such a disproportionate impact from a carbon footprint point of view, but also making sure that we did that safely and effectively and in a way that improved asthma outcomes. So that meant that our guide then went through this expert group, had lots and lots and lots of iterations, and has subsequently been endorsed both by the NHS England and Improvement Inhaler Working Group, but also Asthma UK and the British Lung Foundation.
So, Artie, you've put a lot of work into this asthma guideline, but actually, I know on the Greener Practice website, you've developed it much more than that. It goes much beyond a simple guideline now, doesn't it? So tell me a little bit about the asthma toolkit that's on the Greener Practice website.
Yes. So when we got the guide out, what the guide did is it gave people an approach and it gave people sort of key principles. But what we realised really quickly is it didn't give people the step-by-step, how am I going to do this? How am I going to find all the information I need? How am I going to get the education? What searches do I need to do? What should I be sending patients in terms of SMS messages? Or is there a some patient information leaflet that I can send people to explain this? Where are the areas of quality improvement? Who in the team needs to get involved? And we realise that actually it can seem like this is a simple thing to do. It's not. It's quite complex. We actually needed to go away and we needed to map. So a few of us who were interested in this, we just kind of mapped. We said, where are the areas in our daily practice where we see patients where quality improvement can happen? And so what we've done is we've divided those areas into four different areas. How can we improve the diagnosis? How can we improve disease control? What about device choice? And then inhaler disposal. And we've put together quality improvement projects in all of these areas. And the idea is that the toolkit's now going to be a place where people can go. They can get all the learning they need. So we've got the National Clinical Director for Respiratory, Andrew Menzies-Gow, talking to people on diagnosis. We've got Alex Wilkinson talking to us on device choice. We've got a fantastic video from the Executive Chair of the Primary Care Respiratory Society, Carol Stonham, talking about the approach, actually demonstrating the approach of optimising care first, then talking about inhaler technique, then looking at device choice. So hopefully it's going to make it possible for people to achieve those IIF indicators safely and effectively. And we're going to achieve both high quality and low carbon asthma care, which is what the toolkit's called.
With your asthma hat on then, what do you think are the main issues in how we're providing asthma care in the UK at the moment that might account for some of those poorer outcomes that we've been seeing?
If we go back to 2014, the National Review of Asthma Deaths actually described at the time that they thought part of the reason the UK had sort of fairly poor outcomes from asthma and at quite a high mortality rate was that patients were overly reliant on their reliever inhaler and not taking enough of their preventer inhaler. Now, if you're using more than two, so three or more is the guidance, then you've got a higher risk of asthma attacks, you've got a higher risk of admission to hospital. But then I think there's also an issue about which inhalers we've been prescribing in the UK. 70% of the inhalers that we prescribe are pressurised metered dose inhalers. So they're those aerosol spray inhalers, they're the puffer inhalers. And it's actually really hard to use them correctly. Now, you could say it's hard to use any inhaler correctly. The coordination required to press your inhaler down and take a slow and deep breath at the same time, if you're not using a spacer device in particular, it's not easy. And a lot of people get that wrong. In fact, the majority of people are making critical errors. Now, there was a drive to get everyone to use spacers, but in the real world, most people don't use their spacer device, right? And so I wonder as well whether, partly because we've tendered to use a lot of metered dose inhalers, inhaler technique's not easy with that. And so it may be that people are just not getting the medicine in to where they need it.
It's quite stark that there are a few countries, particularly in Europe, who have better asthma outcomes than we do, who are prescribing the majority of their inhalers as dry powder inhalers, isn't it? Some people might be worried that switching people from meter-dosed inhalers to dry powder inhalers may actually negatively impact people. But when were you using them in the right person for the right reason, that's not the case.
It is absolutely important to make the distinction between population level and patient level. So at population level, I think we can be really confident that there's no correlation between the type of inhalers that we're prescribing and the outcomes at country level. If anything, there's a trend towards those countries that tend to use more dry powdered inhalers having better outcomes, but there's no real, you know, correlation. So at a population level, I don't think we need to worry about switching towards dry powdered inhalers. But at an individual patient consultation level, it very much depends on the patient that you've got. Not everyone's going to be able to use a dry powdered inhaler. The dry powdered inhaler technique is the quick and deep breath that you take in. You don't have to coordinate it. You just prepare your device, however you prepare the different dry powder devices. And then you're taking a quick and deep breath in. That kind of fits most people's inhaler technique anyway, the one that they're using with the metered dose inhaler. But not everybody can do it, and not everyone can do it when they're having an attack, for instance. So it's not going to suit everyone, but it can suit a large number of people. At an individual level, it's a shared decision-making process with that patient.
And over the last 2 or 3 years, there's been quite a lot of awareness raised about the environmental impact, so the carbon footprint of metered dose inhalers, which is significant, whereas dry powder inhalers have a very low carbon footprint. But I guess what you're saying here is being environmentally friendly, it's not simply about swapping people from metered dose inhalers to dry powder inhalers.
No, absolutely not. And actually, the best thing that you can do generally for the environment when it comes to healthcare, not just for asthma, is to make sure people are as well as possible. So any long-term condition, if people have their condition well controlled, they know what to do, their care is optimized, that's almost always going to be the best thing you can do from an environmental point of view as well. Asthma is no different. And the biggest bang for our buck is to make sure that we improve the quality of the asthma care that people have, we improve their control. But yes, meter dose inhalers, I should say, do have an outsize environmental impact, because the propellants in that puffer device are hydrofluorocarbons, which are really powerful greenhouse gases. So they're 1,000 to 3,000 times more powerful than carbon dioxide, which is why, even though they're a very small proportion of our prescribing, in primary care they account for 20 to 25% of our prescribing carbon footprint. And that's why NHS England, or greener NHS, I should say, has sort of singled out inhalers as an area for us to look at. But definitely, when we're thinking about reducing the carbon footprint of inhaler prescribing, the first thing we should be thinking about is optimising people's care, because the best thing we can do is reduce the number of reliever inhalers that people are using, and making sure they're using enough preventer inhalers. That's how we're going to reduce the carbon footprint first.
I think some people worry when we're trying to reduce the environmental impact from asthma care that is going to mean more expensive inhalers, it's going to cost practices more, the NHS more, and we simply can't afford this. Is that the case?
I think we need to think about cost in the round. If people are well controlled, they're not going to be getting symptoms, they're not going to be needing to visit us in healthcare with exacerbations. You know, hopefully less people are going to need to visit hospitals and A&E departments. But even wider than that, you know, if people's asthma is well controlled, think about the school that they're not going to miss if they're a child, or the physical activity that they're going to be able to do, and all of the financial impacts that that has on their health. But even so, there has been studies, even if we look at it more narrowly, if you move from metered dose inhalers and switch to the cheapest dry powdered inhaler equivalent, there's a paper that maybe you can link onto your podcast notes by Alex Wilkinson and James Smith, who both also authors of this guide, that shows that actually isn't, just from a prescribing point of view, necessarily more expensive.
Let me bring Veena in. So you have this really exciting role with NHS England at the moment. Just tell me a little bit about your role and how you came across it.
So I came across it when I was I was sitting on the train to work looking at Twitter, and I saw this role come up on the FMLM, the Faculty of Medical Leadership and Management page, and it was a Chief Sustainability Officer's Clinical Fellow Scheme. And it was new. It was the first year that they'd done it. And they were looking for clinicians who were in training programs or at different stages of their career in sort of outside of medicine. So what I do in my role is I work across two teams, which are both the Greener NHS team and the primary care team at NHS England. And what I'm doing is working on sustainability of the NHS and focusing that specifically on primary care sustainability and the clinical aspects there of our carbon footprint. So my current role is really focusing on sustainable respiratory care. And as lots of you will know, the GP incentive scheme, the Investment and Impact Fund, has just come back at the beginning of April. And so the work we've been doing is really how to implement this and make sure that we get communications out to healthcare professionals and work with different organisations, from Royal Colleges to educational providers such as NB Medical, to different charities, to different leaders in different departments, to make sure that they understand what the messages are about good and green asthma care whilst reducing the carbon footprint.
I think a lot of people won't have heard of Greener NHS before. Are you able to tell me a little bit about that?
So the purpose of Greener NHS is to reduce the carbon emissions of the NHS, because the NHS is about 5% of the UK's carbon emissions, which I think is a fact that surprises a lot of people. It's actually a higher amount of emissions than the aviation industry. The main aspects of carbon emissions in primary care are the clinical aspects. So the inhalers and the medicines are about 60% of the carbon footprint in primary care. There are some other aspects such as the buildings, the water, the waste. The estates is challenging in primary care because of a lot of the ownership models. So because a lot of it is owned by partners or leased from third parties, it's not as easy for the NHS to, for example, give funding for things like solar panels or insulation, whereas for hospitals, because they're owned by the NHS, that can be easier to do. But because we're focusing mainly on the clinical care in primary care, inhalers is one of the work streams, which is really key. And that's why we're focusing on the Investment Impact Fund, which was developed by Greener NHS with a lot of other different teams, as well as looking at medicines. And there's a lot of work going on to look at the carbon footprint of medicines. So Greener NHS is working with several other organisations to try and work out actually what the different carbon footprint of medicines are, because at the moment we don't really know, have that information, and we're just doing it by how much is spent on medicines, which isn't actually a good way of working out what the carbon footprint is, as well as looking at different systems such as medication waste, such as the overprescribing review and how to implement it. So there are quite a few different angles to the primary care carbon footprint that Greener NHS is looking at.
So Vina, would you recommend doing the fellowship?
I would definitely recommend the fellowship. It's been brilliant because I've been able to spend some time with some really inspiring leaders, and I've learned so much from working with them. And it's also just been so interesting to see how the NHS is organised and run. And I just wouldn't have had that level of exposure when in my day-to-day GP training. And I've just learned so much about different areas, from finance to business planning to strategic decision making, but actually mostly about collaboration and team working. And these are skills that I'll take with me into my future career.
It does sound like a brilliant opportunity. So if you are a trainee of any primary care specialty, or indeed if you are a trainer and you think this might be interesting for one of your trainees, then do check it out. I will put a link to the Faculty of Medical Leadership and Management in the podcast description, and that'll take you to the relevant page. So thank you so much for Arti and Vina for joining us on the podcast today. Fascinating insights into asthma and what the NHS is trying to do to improve sustainability. If you want to go into a bit more detail about the clinical management of asthma and how we can optimise our patients' care, then join me for that free clinic on the 17th of May. And in the meantime, I hope you can enjoy some of the nice weather that we are predicted to have. Just remember, as the sun glistens off the top of the pool, as you blow up the Lilo and you crack open a beer, be careful. If a man in a suit told you it was fun, there's probably a shark in there. Look after yourselves. Bye-bye.